Hey, welcome to Sunday's edition of the Daily Bible Podcast.
Happy Lord's Day.
It is the Lord's Day. Yeah, we're back from retreat. We got back last night.
We hope.
In the future, Lord willing.
That's
and
the goal.
And we also hope that it was a great time. We trust that it was.
So. As we record this, it's Thursday, April 18th. So we're recording these plenty of days in advance. But man, I am steeped in it. I am like up to my eyes and beyond. I have been intensively working and slaving over a hot keyboard to put together the best sermons I can put together, to think about the best questions, and I'm really excited about this. So I hope our greatest wishes and desires were fulfilled. We are praying for you by name, as I mentioned to you guys in the email, the men who are listening anyway. So I hope that this has been a productive weekend. That's our goal.
Yep, that is our goal. Well, hey, let's jump into 2 Samuel 1 through 4. Daily Bible reading passage for the day. 2 Samuel 1 through 4, David is going to receive report of Saul's death. And the guy who comes to tell David of Saul's death clearly doesn't, not the sharpest tool in the shed, let's just put it that way. This guy comes and he thinks that David's going to be excited, but David doesn't rejoice at the death of Saul. He doesn't reward the young man who comes to tell him that Saul's dead. And on top of everything else, he inquires of the young man, says, "Hey, where are you from?" And the man says, "Well, I'm an Amalekite." And you'll remember just recently, the Amalekites were the ones that raided Ziklag, the place that David and his men were staying in the Philistine territory there, and carried off their wives and their children and everything else. So this guy, he's got a lot stacked against him. And it's interesting because he claims to have been the one that actually killed Saul. If you recall, in 1 Samuel 31, the death of Saul, it appeared there was an act even of not suicide, because it seemed like he was dying. But it says that Saul fell on his own spear, and it would imply that he took his own life there, or ended his own life at least. The Amalekite here says he happened upon Saul. Saul begged him to kill him, and he did. It's possible that both are true. It's possible that Saul fell on his spear, but before he died, this Amalekite happened to come by him and finished him off. Regardless, this man's boasting in this, thinking that David's going to be pleased with this, and David is anything but pleased. In fact, David orders that this man should be killed for his raising his hand against the Lord's anointed, and then beyond that, being an Amalekite on top of that, just the deck was not stacked in this guy's favor at all.
Seems like the author of Samuel, though, really at least leans toward the fact that this Amalekite is probably not telling the truth. The ending of Samuel, it would be helpful if you could explain why you think that the suicide wouldn't be called a suicide, because that's how I would describe it. Saul killed himself. He committed suicide. And he talks about his life lingering. So I suppose there's a chance he could have lived despite having these injuries and perhaps been subject to the torment and the torture that the Philistines could have brought upon him. So I still think it's that, but why do you see that differently?
Because it was the heat of the battle, and because this was not uncommon during this time. We have other instances biblically where, I forget the exact encounter, but the woman drops the jar from the tower, and he says, "Well, hey, kill me before, you know, people say that this woman killed me." So death, when it was inevitable, people cared about how they died, and they wanted to go out in a noble way. And I think death was inevitable here. I think the Philistines were going to come and kill Saul. I think Saul had been wounded. He knew the writing was on the wall. And I think if he had any hope of survival, knowing what we know about Saul's character prior to this, he was not a man of honor and dignity and courage. And so I think Saul's despairing, knowing what's happening. And so that's why yes, he does take his own life. Technically, is that suicide? Yes, but it's not suicide in the sense of he is ending his life in an unnecessary fashion. He was going to die.
Well, that's certainly true. God did promise that. Remember when he visited the witch at Endor, he told him through Samuel, who the witch brought up from the dead, "You're going to be with me tomorrow." So we know he's going to die, but the hows and the who's a what's it's, that seems to be a subject of question here. Anyway, it's neither here nor there. I was just curious as to your reasoning as to why you wouldn't call that suicide when it seems like that's what it would be.
Yeah. I mean, technical definition, yes, suicide.
But doesn't carry the moral quality is what you're saying.
Right.
You think he's absolved.
Yeah. If he's bleeding out slowly and chooses to end it faster, this is not the same thing as somebody who gets a stage 4 lung cancer diagnosis that's like, okay, I'm going to go get assisted medical suicide.
Do you feel like euthanasia, with that concept in mind, does euthanasia have a place in the Christian life? euthanasia, good death. For those of you guys who are listening, I'm sure you've heard the term before. It's very popular in today's culture, given the idea that life is kind of on your terms, and therefore, if you feel like the pain is too much, you should and you perhaps must have the liberty to take it at your will and discretion. Is that something that you would support, given your understanding of the end of 1 Samuel?
No, I wouldn't. And I'm not necessarily condoning what Saul's doing here as a good thing. It's just when we talk about suicide, typically what comes to mind is the depressed person and so on.
Right, right, right.
Right. So here I'd separate this out as a different category because of the context of the battle that's raging all around them. So, I mean, I think this is a different situation.
Is euthanasia generally a bad thing then?
Yes. Yeah, 100%. Our life is not ours. Life is not ours to take or to take from someone else, certainly. So murder is wrong, and self-murder is a form of murder on top of that. So I would say 100% euthanasia is wrong.
Yeah, I suppose there's complexities there that we could obviously say, but this is an exception. This is an exception. I think we would both agree morphine, end of life care, hospice care when you're
sure.
trying to make someone more comfortable is a good thing. There are questions about when someone's life would naturally cease if you were to take away all the helps and the supports, you know, a 21st century medical machinery and electronics. There's a lot of things that can be done to sustain someone's life when it otherwise would not be sustained.
Right.
But that's different, I think, than just saying, hey, my suffering is too great. I'm young and healthy. This has been a thing before. A young, healthy 20-something-year-old says life is too depressing and too challenging.
Right.
I'd like to die. And the support of the Right to Die movement, as it's called, is often cited as a good thing. You know, life on your terms and death on your terms as well. We wouldn't say that 1 Samuel chapter 30, or 31 rather, is a support of that.
Yeah, I would agree with that, 100%. Yep. Yeah, well, the response from Samuel is not only is he upset at this young man, but he's distraught over the death of both Jonathan and Saul, because we can't forget that Jonathan died as well, and this is David's dear friend, is the one whose soul was knit to his back in 1 Samuel chapter 18 there. So in that sense, David calls for a national mourning on behalf of these two. David calls for Israel to lament for Jonathan. That's understandable, but also for Saul. He wants them to grieve over the loss of the Lord's anointed here. And again, this is consistent with David's spirit elsewhere in 1 and 2 Samuel, where he had opportunities to kill Saul and he chose not to. And so here again, we see when Saul does die, that was not something that David was feigning honor or feigning humility there. David truly did have a spot in his heart for Saul as the Lord's anointed. And here he's mourning the fact that Saul has died, and even is mourning the fact that the nations would have something to glory in over the fact that that Israel had lost their king and lost their ruler.
Some people would say that the stages of grief are you have to go through certain stages to kind of graduate from one to the next and to the other. Let me just free you, if you're a Christian, and say that the stages of grief may be somewhat visible in someone's grieving process. You'll notice here, David doesn't go through denial and then anger and then bargaining and then depression and then he doesn't do that. Grief is going to look different for different people. And you should know that as you interact, if you're personally grieving or if you know someone is grieving, I would not assume that the commonly accepted five stages of grief is something that's hard and fast, is a concrete approach to everyone's suffering here. You'll notice that, again, we don't have the whole narrative of exactly what David did, but you don't see that here. And the only point in that is to suppose that grief is not going to look the same for everybody. In fact, a biblical grief is not sad. I mean, David's sad. He's crying. He's upset about this. And there's real, genuine grief there. But that's not where David stops. He processes it, but it's not the way that it typically is expressed. So just as a heads up, the five stages of grief is not the biblical gospel.
Yeah, that's true, and that's helpful. Yeah, 2 Samuel 1:25-26, just want to point out these two verses here, as these have also been some verses that people have used to point to something untoward happening between David and Jonathan. And that's not, again, what is meant here. When David says that his love surpassed the love of women, there's nothing immoral in that statement. He's speaking of the intimacy of their friendship. And I think the other thing we have to bear in mind is consider how many wives David has at this point in time. The culture of marriage was very different during this time than it is for you and I today. And especially as believers today, we have a different understanding of marriage. Whereas I don't think I would point to any guy ever and say that his love was more significant than the love of my wife. I don't think there's a man on earth who will ever surpass that. And I don't really desire for there to ever be a man on earth who ever surpasses that. But I think in David's time, it was a different context. And so this is not anything that is, again, questionable or morally suspect here. David is just simply pointing to the intimacy that he enjoyed with Jonathan, which was different than anything he had ever experienced with a woman when he had a very almost a utilitarian approach to marriage at the time.
Yeah, that is different, even though I do think today the right thing is to have your wife be your best friend, your spouse is your best friend, but that does not exclude or preclude the having and the pursuing of really close same-sex friendships. And perhaps because of the perversion that we see today, the apprehension felt in most men, I think, is sad, because that leaves us in positions where this kind of thing is like nowhere even near. We're not even in the same ballpark as in the Western mindset. Again, I think we're cheating ourselves. I think the biblical model is set up as something of a paradigm that is good and right and should be in some way pursued. Even if it's not going to be the same, you would never say, "Oh, your love is better than, you know, my wife's." But still, I think it's a good thing, and I think we're missing out.
Fair. All right. 2 Samuel chapter 2. Then David is taken and made king, and he is made king first at Hebron. And so it is not everybody that's going to make David king, because in verses 8-11, Saul's son Ishbosheth is also going to be made king. And so you've got competing kings here. And the northern tribes we're not in the divided kingdom. Hello. Some of the tribes are going to follow Ishbosheth, and yet there's others that are going to align with David. And so you're going to have basically a civil war that's set up that plays itself out in the rest of chapter 2 here, where they come together and they battle, and there's a mini battle that's proposed where they say, let's send the best of the best up there and see what happens. And they basically all kill each other, and that launches a massive battle, and David's forces end up winning the day. But in the process, something that is going to create ripple effects for the next handful of chapters happens, and that is Joab has a brother who pursues Abner. And Abner was Saul's Joab, and Abner was kind of Saul's general, his right-hand man. And so Joab's brother is pursuing Abner, and Abner's looking back at him going, hey, look, it's over. You guys have won. Let up, because I don't want to have to kill you. And he warns him multiple times. And Joab's brother won't back off. And Abner is left to take things into his own hands. And he ends up killing Joab's brother. And Joab begins to pursue him and eventually finally agrees to call things off after a period of time. But this is not going to be the end of this. We're going to see this cycle back around later on in the book.
Yeah, you probably should start paying attention to some of these names because you're going to want to track them throughout the narrative here. Joab's going to be around for a little bit. So he's a name that you're going to want to tuck away into your mind and think, okay, who is he? What is he doing? What's his character like? Because he's going to play some pretty significant roles as we move forward here. But just keep Joab in your mind. That's going to stick around. 1 Chronicles 3:1-4 is going to be a parallel passage to 2 Samuel 3, at least the first part of it anyway. So just know, as we start getting into 2 Samuel, you're going to see a lot of overlap between this and Chronicles, because it chronicles the kings of Judah. And of course, the first and the most significant is going to be David.
All right, well, 2 Samuel chapter 3, we get into the war between David's house and Saul's house. And notice this, it's going to last 2 years here. This is something that only lasts a matter of a chapter or thereabouts in our Bibles, but this is a protracted war. This is drawn out. This is not something that happens quickly here. So it's a 2-year battle. And in the course of this, sons are born to David during this time, including in verses 2-5, Amnon. Amnon is not going to be a good dude, and Absalom, who's also not going to be a good guy. So two of David's sons born during this time are going to end up being pretty evil, pretty wicked men, and we'll see that as the rest of this plays out. But in verses 6-11, Ishbosheth accused Abner here of sleeping with his father's concubine and dishonoring him. And that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back for Abner. So Abner makes an amazing declaration. He says, I'm going to go see the throne established in David's hand, and the Lord do so to me and more if I don't. And so there's another one of those vows. And so he leaves to go do that. And then following this, he talks to David, says, David, I want to come over to you. And David says, okay, but I want Michal back. I want Michal. I want my wife back. Because remember, we'd mentioned this a couple episodes ago. David's wife had been given to another man. And so this is a pretty sad scene. for many reasons. But here you have this woman taken away from the man that she had been with, who follows after her weeping while she's taken back there to King David. And so again, marriage is not it's not in a strong position at this point in time in Israel's history as far as the value of it and the import of it and cherishing it the way that we do perhaps today.
Poor Michal. I mean, that stinks for her. She's kind of just being tossed to and fro. She's a casualty of war and of antimony between Saul and David, and this poor woman is just being sent back and forth. And just let's just make a note here that sin has fallout effects that really hurts everyone else around it. Sin is never self-contained. It's not only relegated to those to whom the sin was committed, but also so many people around. Saul's sin affected his entire kingdom, and it also included his closest family, Michal being one of those people that's just being tossed about. She's given to this guy, she's given to that guy, she was David's first, now she's Paltiel's, and now he's going back to David. That's a terrible situation. Make note of that. Sin never stays contained. It like cancer, will spread and will hurt everyone else around you.
Yeah. She's not going to acquit herself very well later on in the book, though, so feel bad for her right now, but not too bad. Not too bad. Yeah, verses 17 through 19, then Abner shows a knowledge of the prophecy that David would be the next king of Israel here. Notice that. He affirms that this is going to happen in accordance with what God has said would happen. Verses 20 through 25, though, I mentioned this was going to circle back around, and here we find it. Not everybody is super excited, though, that Abner has come to join forces with David, and Joab happens to be one of those who's not too excited about that. And so he takes matters into his own hand, deceives Abner into a private meeting where Joab murders him in retaliation for the wartime killing of his brother. Joab's wrong for doing this, and there's really no other way around it. What he does is justifiable in the sense of avenging a family member. You can see the why, but that was war, that was battle, and Abner had multiple times warned his brother to let off pursuing him. And so Joab is not right for his actions here. And that's why David responds the way he does in publicly declaring his innocence. And he kind of cuts the legs out from his right-hand man here. He says, this guy's wrong. I was not behind this. This was wrong. This should not have done. And he actually calls for mourning for Abner, which probably didn't sit well with Joab. But Joab shouldn't have done what Joab did here.
Amen to that.
Yeah, chapter 4 then, Ish-bosheth is going to die. There's a couple of bad guys here in his own army that think that they're going to be able to get ahead with David by killing Ish-bosheth, and clearly these guys didn't follow what happened with the guy who killed Saul or reported to kill Saul. So they sneak into the guy's house while he's asleep at night, and they murder him, and they come back to David, and they say, look, here's your enemy's head. He's dead, and they expect David to be excited about that, and they're not. Instead, they're met with David's outrage, and just like the messenger who brought news of Saul's death, these men are also killed for their actions. So this kind of brings to end the 2 years of civil war that take place between Saul's house and David's house after the death of Saul, before David's ultimately going to be made king over all of Israel.
Now, notice here, it is still God overseeing the narrative, but this is not a good situation. This is sin. This is wrong for them to do. And David responds rightly by saying, look, you took the life of an innocent man. Now, you're going to suffer for that as well. By the way, these guys' names are Baanah and Rechab. You see that there in verse 2, it looks like. So this is a bad situation, but God's going to redeem it and utilize it for his good purposes. And that's always what he does. He's going to take a sinful, messy situation, and even a sinful, messy king who starts off really well, but really struggles as he hits middle age and beyond. And he's going to use it. He's going to use it for his purposes and his glory. So as you prepare to you strap yourself in for the book of 2 Samuel and Chronicles and Kings, things are going to get really hairy really quick. But just be mindful of the fact that God is superintending the whole process. He's using the good, the bad, and the ugly to create a story that is worthy of his glory.
He is. Well, keep reading your Bibles and tune in again tomorrow while we continue, not with 2 Samuel, but with the book of Psalms. And we'll see you then.
See you then.
Bye. Hey, thanks for joining us for another episode of the Daily Bible Podcast. We hope and pray this has been a blessing to you and your time in the Word. If it has, if you would subscribe to this podcast, leave a like, leave a comment, and share it with some friends and family, that would be awesome. If you need more information about Compass Bible Church here in North Texas, you can go to compassntx.org. Again, that's compassntx.org. And we'll be back with you tomorrow for another episode of the Daily Bible Podcast.